Okay, at this time we begin the technical net. This is Kilo 2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, along with Mel, K2KEY, and a little help from N2EO and a few other people to try to help people along with this slightly complicated hobby called ham radio. Slightly complicated. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio, and 2-meter FM ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 or 27 kinds. So if for some reason one of the kinds you're using is not tickling your fancy, consider using one of the others before giving up the hobby itself. Those who listen to the TechNet usually find out an awful lot about how transmission lines work and how antennas work and favorite rigs and modes of modulation and how receivers work and propagation and so on. There's a lot to it. Not all of it's in the book. And Mel and I and others try to cover that portion that's not in the books, or we try to make more clear what's in the books that's not always so understandable. A person who has a question or a comment for the TechNet signs in by giving his call letters, his name. You got to give me your name because I'm so darn forgetful. And followed by a yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name and say yes at this time. K2LIW listening.
This is W2OSRIW. The name is Joe, and yes, and I'm mobile.
N2EO.
W2IGH. The name is Hugo, and yes.
He's such a nice guy.
Okay, we had a few triples there. I got Bob. I got Rich. Joe, give me your call letters again.
Yeah, this is KT2QYW, and the name is Joe.
Okay, we have QYW, Joe, Bob, OSR, Rich, and 2EO, and Hugo. Hugo, please give me your call letters.
W2, India Golf Hotel, IGH.
I'm pretty sure you and I have talked quite a few times before, Hugo. Okay, who else was checking in?
KC2OLA Mike.
Whiskey 2, Tango, Tango, Tango. Question, just a comment, that you're such a nice guy. You really are.
Okay, I've got Mike, KC2OLA, Whiskey 2, Triple Tango. What is your name, sir?
Gordon, and I just wanted to make a comment that you're such a nice, friendly guy. And not to mention informative. Thank you.
Okay, Gordon. Obviously, you have good taste. And the check's in the mail. I keep paying Gordon, and he keeps giving those testimonials, and I thank you, Gordon. All right, we have more than enough to get started. If you didn't get a chance to check in yet, not to worry. as long as you put some toothpicks in your eyelids and can stay up late enough, Mel and I usually stay in there late enough to try to give all of our comments. So let's start off with Joe, who was the first guy who signed in. Mr. QYW, go right ahead, Joe. My name is Dick.
Yeah, hi Dick and Mel and everybody on the net, and I thought everybody was nice. You're all nice. I'm mobile right now, so I might be picking it. Okay, quick question. I just finished setting up a PV antenna, believe it or not. How far away does that PV antenna have to be towards my amateur radio antenna up there on the roof too? It's 2-meter amateur radio. My question is, how far apart you think?
In some circumstances, Joe, they can be mounted on the exact same sheet of aluminum, the exact same piece of aluminum tubing, on the exact same mast. Now, how far apart has got two or three different kinds of an answer. Answer number one would be where I transmit in one and receive on the other, and it works. The easiest case would be to transmit on a ham radio, let's say 2 meters, or 30 megacycles for that matter, or 80 meters for that matter, and listen on 27 megs. If there is enough filtering in the front end of the receiver, of the 27 meg receiver, so that it's not overloaded by simple, strong, local signal, even though that signal is a zillion megacycles away, as long as there's enough filtering, they can work simultaneously, no problem. The worst situation I can think of is a second harmonic of 27 megs is approximately 54. If you are a 6-meter ham radio operator trying to operate at 50 1.2 megacycles. Now that could be a fairly serious filter requirement to make sure the receiver is not overloaded. So the nice thing about an antenna, and the thing that's not very well advertised and not very well described in all the good books that show, is that every good antenna doing transmitting first must be resonated. Then it can radiate. When I say resonated, I don't mean necessarily the antenna. I mean the total antenna system. Antenna, impedance matching device, feed line, antenna tuner, and final stage of the transmitter. That combination, once it resonates, will radiate very well. If it doesn't resonate, it radiates very poorly, and it picks up signals very poorly. So when you're transmitting on 27 megs, and a bit right alongside of it, 2 feet away, is an antenna on 144 megacycles, 146 megacycles, this frequency. So 146 does not resonate at 27 megs, not harmonically related. Therefore, the amount of signal picked up on the 146 megacycle antenna when you're transmitting on 27 megs will be extremely small. In watts, it'll be difficult to measure. It would take a laboratory equipment to measure it. That's the good news. The bad news is if the 146 megacycle receiver didn't have a filter in front of it and didn't have a slightly bulletproof front end in its electronic design, then it could experience simple front end overload from a local transmitter. But with a filter, very solvable. And also, if you study the effective capture areas of antennas, you'll find something very similar. Your 146 megacycle antenna may have a 1 square foot effective area on 146 megacycles. On 27 megacycles, this effective capture area might be 1/16th of a square inch. And I'm not kidding. So, and vice versa, because it doesn't resonate. The area comes from resonance. So, with a little bit of care and filtering, I think you can mount them on the exact same mast. As you push them further apart, the filter requirement decreases. But if you're limited in real estate where you can measure them, where you can mount them, you can make them as close as you like, and with proper filtering, you can make it work. The technology is there. It's just a matter of whether or not you decide to apply it, Joe. KC2QYW, KQRIW on the TechNet.
Okay. One more quick one. I'm using that, I think it's called a 99A TV antenna, and it also does 10 meters. And my super told me, can you put it on the same water pipe up there? And the water pipe is pretty thick. It's like maybe 5 inches round. So what I did was I put it on the opposite side of the of my 2 meter amateur radio that I have at home, the base one. But you know, of course, I'm gonna use it like if I'm using my amateur radio, I'll have the other radio off. So I don't think it should interfere. Am I correct? So I hope I did it right.
Yeah, if I understand correctly, I think you've got no problem. The amount of energy that will be coupled from one antenna into the other will be quite small. It won't damage the radio whether it's turned on or turned off. When it's turned on and you try to receive, you might experience some front-end overload. Even though the total number of watts transfers from the 27 meg into the ham radio antenna is going to be extremely small, most of us will be amazed how little power it takes on the wrong frequency to create front-end overload of a piece of ham radio equipment that doesn't have a good bulletproof front-end design. Some of them do, some of them do not. It's one of the ratings that's not very clearly made in any of the rating sheets. And even if at worst you run into that problem, you can add a filter to fix it. So I think you can keep your super happy by mounting multiple antennas on the same mast. The fact that the mast is 5 inches in diameter at these frequencies is not significant. I'll admit that if you were mounting a Yagi with a mounting clamp in the middle of the boom of the Yagi, and you put right alongside of that boom a 5-inch diameter pipe, which is pretty massive, yes, it will detune the Yagi. If on top of the mast you're mounting a ground plane, or if the Yagi is a rear mounted type where it sits in front of that 5-inch pieces of tubing, no problem. So there's ways around that. Back to you, Joe.
Yeah, roger, roger. Well, the 99A antenna is a very, very tall antenna. It's way taller than my 4-foot 2-meter antenna. Hooked up to 5 foot mast, you know. So I got a ten foot mast, and then I hooked up the 99A onto that 10 foot mast. If I put a little flag up there, you guys probably see it from all the way from Long Island. That's how high up it is on a six story building. And I did something nice to my super. I gave him a free CV, you know, just for having me do all that work up there. And then in the future, I'm going to put a dipole up there, so I shouldn't have a problem, you know. All right, all my questions are done, and I'm going to give it back to you guys. And thank you very much. This is KC2QYW. I'll be listening.
Okay, let us know how that all turns out, Joe. And when you try it, whether you be successful or unsuccessful, come on back and tell us about it. Next person who signed in was Bob, W2OSR. Is the man who's poured a good piece of concrete. By now it's getting nice and hard. Is sitting there saying, boy, I wish there was an antenna connected on top of it. W2OSR, K2RIW.
Yeah, hi, Dick. Well, I got to mount an antenna on it. I'll use the RF to secure it with the net. My question for the evening is I'm getting ready to build a 7-element computer. I've got most of it worked out on net. I'm curious as to what people think would be the best method of using the driven element.
Okay, I published an article on that exact subject, Bob. You can get a hold of the article by going to Dr. Tom Williams' website, the microwave website, but ignore that and just go to the bottom of the website. It's WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. You go to Tom Williams' website, and just in case I got it wrong with .org versus .something else, you can always Google those call letters and you'll find him immediately. Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha. And at the bottom of that, you'll find an article about Yagis by K2RIW. From that article, you'll discover that there are a large number of ways of constructing, a large number of ways of feeding the driven element of a Yagi. Every single one of those will match any Yagi you want if you follow that article. The gist of the article is the magic that has been such a well-kept secret up till now. I've tried publishing it with QST. They turned it down. I tried publishing it with a number of places in the United States. They turn it down. They think the subject is boring. I've been published in Australian magazines, it's published in New Zealand magazines, it's published in the United Kingdom, but the United States doesn't care about it. So the only way I can publish it here to give my ham radio friends in the United States the information is to put it on Tom Williams' website. And as I said, the gist is that by adjusting the length of the driven element, irrespective of what kind of Yagi, irrespective of how long is your reflector, where is your director, how long is the director, irregardless of it, here we go. Irrespective of all that jazz, as you make the length of the driven element go from too short to too long, the resistive component of impedance can slide from 1 ohm to 1,000 ohms in a continuous manner. I'm amazed that that's such a well-kept secret. So making the resistive component 50.000 ohms, if that's what you want, or 71.125 ohms, if that's what you want, is easy. Once you choose the right length to make your resistive component exactly what you want, then all you've got to do is correct the reactive component that's usually left over. If you follow my advice, you'll end up with the reactive component that was suggested in the article. If you follow that advice, the reactive component will most of the time end up inductive. If you create a small shunt capacitor across the center of the dipole, the reactive component disappears and you're there. And the Biswar can be made 1.01 if that's what you desire. And once you have the procedure down pat and you know what you're doing, you will get that degree of success within 5 minutes. And I'm not kidding. It is that simple once you understand the principle. And it's such an extremely well-kept secret. It's not published in any book. When I put it on Tom Williams' website, a number of companies where the chief engineer designs ships and sells antennas wrote me accolades that you wouldn't believe, saying it's about time somebody published this. So feeding the driven element by whatever mechanical construction you want to make a perfect impedance match, whether the driven element is a dipole all by itself in free space or in the middle of the most exotic Yagi you and I can imagine, once you understand the principle, it's like falling off a log. You'll love it. W2OSR, K2LAW on the TechNet.
Okay, W2OSR, and to answer your question is WA1MCA.org, and there is this information, K2RIW, a nice photograph of Dr. Yagi antenna, and a description of the concept of Yagi matching, T-match, and general matching. Click here, which I will do in a few minutes. Thank you.
Okay. And on the assumption you have any trouble understanding it, once you read the two articles are there. One's a very brief introduction. The other one is 4,000 words on the subject. Come on back and tell us if you like it or you don't like it. And Mel and I can take it. We've had some arrows shot at us from time to time. We know we don't always keep everybody happy. Good luck with that, Operation Bob. Rich was the next person who signed in, N2 Echo Oscar. This guy I think is thinking of taking up ham radio, who lives in Whitestone. Go ahead, Rich.
It occurred to me once in a while I might take up this crazy hobby. Good evening, Dick. I did search last week for somebody else crazy enough to wear the second tube to an AL-1500, and I came up with somebody who's sort of an amplifier maven. You look him up on the Internet. It's called WBHWJU. Go to QYZ, as I'll give you the. He's got his homepage on there. I think among the show's amplifiers, he's got a 4CX 3000 and something called a 3CT 5008. So this guy is, not playing around. Turns out we were parallel thinking because he ran into the same problems I ran into with the AL-1500, and we pretty much solved them the same way. Got a question for you, Dick. On that extra intellectual capacitance, I'm looking for a unique way to possibly tune that out. That's a shunt capacitance from plate to grid. Grid is ground, so it's plate to ground. I wonder if a small coil with a blocking cap, coil made out of copper strap, and a blocking cap going from plate to ground might tune that out. Or a small coil on the plate side before the it enters the Pi network, just to tune out the capacitive reactants on 10 meters thick. Back to you, K2RIW, N2EO.
Yeah, interesting question you ask, Rich. Every tube has got grid to cathode capacitance, grid to screen capacitance, grid to plate capacitance, and so on, plate to ground capacitance. Good common sense would lead you to believe you put the right kind of opposite reactants across it. In other words, since the inter-electrode reactant is capacitive, it would stand to reason that if you put an inductor across it with the right topography, you'll cancel the reactant and it'll no longer be there. And if the tube was a purely passive device, that would probably be adequate. But because the tube has built-in gain, because that gain creates a certain phase shift, unless you're down at DC frequencies, there's always a phase shift to that gain. Therefore, simply nulling the reactants is not enough. You're rather likely to end up with an unstable circuit when you do that. Therefore, the time-honored technique for getting around this problem is called neutralization. Every self-respecting tube amplifier, where you want maximum performance, best linearity, best stability under all conditions, the right way to do it is a neutralizing network. Once you properly set up and properly align a neutralizing network, the effects, the bad effects of the inter-electrode capacitance essentially disappears. once that neutralizing network is installed and running properly. Now, to neutralize at 10 meters only is easy. To neutralize across every one of the bands where your amplifier could work is going to be more difficult. If you're real crafty in the way you build a neutralizing network, I believe it is possible to neutralize all frequencies simultaneously. In the worst situation, your range switch, your band switching switch, might require a little bit of work on the neutralizing network as you change bands in order to pick up the neutralization. But I strongly recommend you consider neutralization as opposed to simple reactance cancellation. Because with the gain of the tube and the phase shift, that could not be enough. And inadvertently, you might be designing an extremely high power oscillating circuit there, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. Maybe the next time, once you started to say it, I kind of got the idea you were going to bring up neutralization. Yeah, when we don't have so many people on the TechNet, because I'm not doing this right away, maybe we can go into possibly how that can be done. I've seen where they put like a copper strap on a feed-to insulator into the plate compartment, so it couples maybe a few picofarads from one or both tubes a few inches away, something like that, and I don't know how it'd be coupled into a grid because the grid is ground, but we'll go into that at a later date. By the way, if you go on that fella's website, I have his phone number, I have to call him up. He gave me the name of a company in Massachusetts where he got a custom transformer, a company called MAGCAP, MAGCAP.com, MAGCAP. He gave me the phone number. And I even have a picture of the transformer here that they found. He said it's the same as the original, with about an amp. He said it was an amp and a half. I'm not sure if he said ICS or CCS service. A little higher voltage. He said it's a little bit bigger, but and it fits in a little tight, but it goes in very well. So I think I'm on my way to solving the problem, Dick. K2RIW N2EO.
Dick, comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Hey, there was a very involved interest in neutralization years ago, of course, and there was a very good paper that was written, trying to remember by who. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was written by the heck was his name that wrote the handbook. Let me think if I can remember his name for a minute. Anyhow, it'll come to me in a second. He actually showed in a very good diagram that two electro capacitors, he represented it by using what we call the star connection of three capacitors. So in other words, he put together the three capacitors of a tube, the plate, the cathode, the plate, and the grid. And he's got a very good formula for determining what exactly you need for the intellectual capacitance of any tube. I'm trying to remember, oh God, why am I can't remember his call letters that the guy who did this work. All right, it'll come to me in a minute. I just can't seem to come up with the name right now, Dick.
Bill Orr?
Was it possibly Bill Orr, W6SAI?
That's him, William Orr. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you, Rich. Yeah. He wrote a very nice handbook. When you study neutralization networks, you look at the schematic diagram, Rich, you'll be kind of amazed. It looks like positive feedback. It looks like you're creating an oscillator out of your amplifier. However, it's an extremely controlled magnitude, very small mode, very small magnitude, extremely well controlled, and exactly 180 degrees out of phase. The intra-electrode capacitance within the tube tends to be a negative feedback. in which case you would say, gee, it should be stable as all hell. Well, when you get reactive circuits involved, it doesn't turn out to be that simple. So it's essentially a positive feedback network. It looks like you're trying to make an oscillator, except that you don't couple it tight enough to break into oscillation. And once you study those diagrams, and even though you've got a grounded grid amplifier, there is definite advantages in neutralizing as far as I am told, although I haven't always experienced it quite the way I like, I'm told that when an amplifier is properly neutralized, that at the instant you dip the plate current by adjusting the plate tuning capacitor, that's essentially the exact same spot that will be maximum power output, whereas without neutralization, power output maximum and plate current dipping do not correspond. This is one of the ways you get a hint that you're not very well neutralized. Well, it's not quite as simple as that. That's the way it's usually stated. In reality, with a PI output network, which is a very popular output network, the tube circuit, your C1 tuning capacitor and your C2 loading capacitor do interact. So therefore, the tipping of the plate tuning capacitor, the C1, even with proper neutralization, it's a little bit off to one side at the dip where you get maximum power output because of the interaction of those two networks. On top of that, when you properly redraw the topography of a PI output tuning network or impedance matching network, when you properly redraw it, you'll suddenly realize that your C1 capacitor and your C2 capacitor are a capacitor divider network, which is behaving in a very similar manner as if you had a tap point across the resonating coil. And so that gives you a hint as to how impedance matching takes place. Well, the nice thing about the PI network is that you're able to continuously move the position of the tap, whereas really tapping the coil, you can only tap each individual turn, and it's very difficult to tap, say, the half turns in between, so to speak. So PI is very popular, and with a little more understanding, you'll fall in love with it a little bit more than you already have. We'll hear from you a little bit later, I'm pretty sure, Rich. Hugo was the next person who signed in. Whiskey 2, India Golf Alpha. Go right ahead, Hugo. KQLIW.
Oh, okay. Okay, Dick. Hello there. And the call is Whiskey 2, India Golf Hotel. The last letter is an H. Well, Dick, it's been a very long time since I talked to you. I get very seldom on the...
Hugo, you may have let go of your mic button.
Time to time. In fact, quite often, because I'm just interested in, what the questions are and so forth. Well, the other day, I think it was a few weeks ago, you were explaining to somebody something about the propagation. We're on the bottom of the cycle, and we're sort of on the verge of an upswing, which probably won't occur until about five years from now or so, at the peak. And you mentioned that the higher frequencies are the last ones to improve. You know, you first start with the lower frequencies. You find out that the lower frequencies go first and the higher ones come a little bit later. Or not as strong as the lower frequencies. So you were explaining that, and the other day I was on 80 meters. There's a net called the Marconi net. It is on 80 meters, and they did discuss various technical details. Not into as much as you do, but they do discuss questions and so forth. And there was a professor on there. His call was W4AKO. And he was saying, and I asked him the same question, because you mentioned that in the winter time propagation is better than in the summertime. You know, usually there is a difference that in the winter time it improves and the summer is not so good. And you said that really the reason for that, it was still up in the air. Really, nobody, I guess, knows technically why that is. So he mentioned, I asked him the question, and he mentioned that this was because that it depended on the location, where you're located on the globe, you know, so forth. But he did not really explain that to me. But I'm just wondering whether you know about this net at W4AKO. And also he mentioned that, I think they called it cycle 19, which occurred, I think, the peak of it occurred in the 1957, 58, 59, that year. And he claimed that no other cycle after that, up to the present time, you know, came up to the same level as the cycle at that. That was the peak of the cycle, came up to that same level. And I think he called it cycle 19. And he claimed that predictions were that our coming the peak of our coming peak of our cycle would be even better than that one. That was the predictions that were so far. Now I was just wondering what your feelings are about those comments. So back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Hugo. You and I last talked to each other when we were trading an antenna that was won as a prize at a Limog meeting, and I think I purchased the mag mount antenna from you. And as I remember, you were a teacher in the Syosset area at the time. You and I last saw each other face to face probably 10 or 15 years ago. My goodness, a lot of water under the bridge since then. I'm not completely familiar with the Marconi net or W4EKO, Arno Costco, who lives in Marshall, Virginia. When you go to his website, so to speak, by going to QRZ.com and typing in W4AKO, you see a beautiful picture of his house in Virginia and a nice explanation of how he got into ham radio in 1948. He started getting interested in electronics in Germany during World War II and so on. I can tell that Arnold has quite a lot of experience. Now, among my VHF friends, we all talk about the good old days, but those guys will talk with tears in their eyes almost when they describe how good 6 meters was in 1958. That particular sunspot cycle was the record for modern mankind. I don't think anything like that sunspot cycle has existed since 1900. And if it did exist in 1900, because there was no VHF radio, they wouldn't really know about it as far as that characteristic is concerned. But that particular sunspot cycle was so intense that people on 6 meters and 2 meters were experiencing tremendous band openings in range and duration and signal strength and so on. So that the ionosphere, the state of the ionosphere, at least for HF and VHF frequencies, seems to be very strongly influenced by what the sun is doing now. And during a very high activity sunspot cycle, when there's a whole lot of these sunspots, the sunspots themselves, if you are into astronomy, and I am a little bit, and if you do what's called white light polar observing, that really means you take a piece of Baader film, B-A-A-T-E-R, a German company that makes this silvery film that you buy for not very many dollars. You mount it in a frame, and you put that on the front of your binoculars, you put it on the front of your telescope, whatever you've got that can observe the sun. You put this filter on it. It has a level 5, level 5, what do they call that? Not range 5, but magnitude 5 attenuation. Since those magnitudes are rated in 10 to the power, that really means it cuts down the amount of solar intensity by a 100,000 to 1 ratio, 0.1 million to 1 ratio. You put that in front of your telescope and you look at the sun and you see a very beautiful object, and the sunspots themselves show up very distinctly. The sunspots are places where, because of a magnetic storm occurring at that particular location on the solar surface, the sun is 1,500 or so degrees, in other words, 1,500 degrees cooler in that spot because of intense magnetic fields coming together at that spot, and the normal bubbling up of the material going on at the surface gets disturbed. But those spots also are usually locations of solar mass expulsion. In other words, tremendous millions of pounds of material get squirted out of those holes, and when it hits our ionosphere a day or two or three later, when it gets here, does many of the ionospheric effects that you see. So a solar storm created by sunspots strongly affects our ionosphere, and when the ionosphere experiences a sufficiently high ionization level, by that I mean the experts talk about how many free electrons, how many plasma electrons per cubic meter or per cubic centimeter are formed. And what plasma really means is you've taken the nucleus of a molecule of air up high, numbers like 60 kilometers up. You take the nucleus of the air molecule and you strip it away, or you strip the electron away from it. And so when the electron and the nucleus that it used to go around are now separated from each other, you have a conducting medium. And that's what the plasma is. It's the fourth state of matter: solid, liquid, gas, plasma. It's the highest energy state that I know of matter. But once matter is in the plasma state, and that's what the ionosphere is, it's a conductive medium. And that conductive medium, when a radio wave hits it, gets modified. We call it bounce off the ionosphere. The real process at the microscopic level is more complicated than that. The majority of what goes on is excitation and re-radiation. So your radio wave hitting that conductive layer, that plasma layer called ionosphere, you could say shakes up those molecules. And if you're doing it at the 30 megacycle frequency, at 30 million times per second, you're shaking those molecules, and they absorb some of that energy and re-radiate it in some other direction. For the most part, it's angle of incidence equals angle of reflection, and it looks like a mirror-like reflection. But there's something more complicated going on. But when you combine that reflection with the Earth's magnetic field that are mixed together, you now have the phenomena of Faraday rotation. And the big experiment that Mel is finding out about is that many, if not a high percentage, certainly many, and I think a high percentage, of the fades that you and I experience on any of the HF frequencies during a QSO. You think the signal has hopped over your house, or it underhopped and overhopped is what you think. It is my belief that a high percentage of the time, the signal is arriving at your house nice and strong, but it's cross-polarized. Because of Faraday rotation, you launch a horizontal signal, it goes through the ionosphere, twists a couple of times before it gets out of the ionosphere and comes back down to the Earth and goes to your buddy's house X number of miles away. And even though you've launched a horizontal signal and you think he's going to get a horizontal signal, a certain percentage of the time, he gets a vertically polarized signal from you. And if his antenna is not set up properly, he gets a tremendously decreased signal strength. So Mel has discovered that with these loop antennas that he builds in the shack with him, because the loop antenna on, say, 80 meters is only a fraction of a wavelength in diameter and properly tuned, but because it's so small, he can rotate it in azimuth, rotate it in elevation, and really rotate it in polarization. So this tenth of a wavelength loop in the shack with him is giving him a more reliable signal and a stronger signal in S-meter deflection than the full one wavelength long loop mounted 45 feet in the air with four towers in his backyard. Let me repeat that one, Hugo. You get a kick out of this. A full wavelength loop, 45 feet in the air on all four towers, full 270 feet long loop in circumference, doesn't give him as much signal as a tenth of a wavelength loop mounted in the shack with him when he properly orients it. So the ionosphere is a bit more complicated than all this one to admit, and the fact that this little nugget of information hasn't been made a hell of a lot more clear is kind of amazing to me. So maybe I should listen a little bit more to the Marconi net. Maybe I should try to meet Arno. He sounds like a fascinating guy. He takes a nice picture of his house that I see at QIZ.com. I think I also see that he used to have another set of call letters Where was that? Oh, I know where I can find it. He's now Whiskey 4 Alpha Kilo Oscar. He used to be Kilo India 4 Delta Oscar Tango. So thank you for bringing that to my attention, Hugo. W2 India Golf Hotel. Finally got it right. KQLIW.
Oh, okay, Jake. That was very interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. That's why I like to listen to, you know, on Sundays. Yeah, his call was Fred, KB2IXT. That's India X-Ray Tango. And the net is, I think it's a daily net. I usually listen to it on a Friday or a Saturday. But it's a net on 3.872 megahertz. So it's 3.872, and it stops at 9 o'clock, at 9 o'clock in the evening. If you you know, if you're interested, in fact, I think you would be very welcome there because you have a lot of information about this. If you get on 80 meters. Thank you very much, Dick. And yeah, I remember that we, I think I swapped or something. I gave you this Mac Bound. I think it was the Mac. Now that you mentioned it, I recall it. It was a long time ago. Like you said, it was probably around 15 years. Okay, Dick, I'll mention something else later on. So, I'll turn it back to you now so you can go through the list. Thanks a lot, there, Dick.
Yeah, comment, Dick, K2KY. I'm going
to turn it over to Mel in a second. And Hugo, you got to check in a little bit more often. Haven't heard from you in a long time. And used to hear you rather frequently on the 8.5 frequency. Go right ahead, Mel.
Now, you know, just a comment. You just mentioned 1958. That was one of the strangest effects I think that's ever been observed. We went in 1954, we had the minimum of the group, the sunspot numbers, I think it was like 3. In about approximately 3 years, it was November, around November 1957, just before the end of the year, we went to a group, so sunspot numbers. That was the highest ever registered, was 199.5, just under, a little under, a little point under, half a point under 200. And it was, since now, they've been counting, I understand, they've been counting sunspots for a long, long time. It's not since, you know, just the advent of radio communication that this has been observed for quite a long time. And has never was observed again, and they doubt it's such a strange anomaly that they don't know if we'll ever possibly see one for, who knows, maybe hundreds of years. That's why I remember that the bands were just constantly, for a period of time of around November 1957 until that maximum. Dropped off somewhat, but very small amount dropped off, maybe 10 points in the following month, but last right up to 1957, November, to around almost 1962. That was quite a run for that high number takeover.
That sure was. Yeah, Hugo was asking me, do I believe the next sunspot cycle is going to counter, is going to challenge that particular one? There I don't know. I'm not a big sunspot studier as far as the statistics of it, Hugo. I am skeptical if people say that it's going to be as strong as 1958. It's such a rare event. I mean, mankind has been studying the sunspots with good and not so good records since the 1700s, to my knowledge, and probably even before that. I think there are Chinese records that go back a tremendously amount further. And so, extremely rare event, and I'm having trouble believing it's going to happen quite like that again in my lifetime. I'd be pleasantly surprised if it did. However, the way our technology is improving, where we've got We're developing higher gain antennas, higher power output transmitters, more sensitive receivers, modulation and demodulation techniques that are through the roof, so to speak. You take, for instance, the Joe Taylor techniques, the K1JT techniques, where he transmits a series of four tones in various combinations, and he's able to get through a printed message where the signal-to-noise ratio is 28 dB negative, 28 dB below the noise. So long-range tropo, long-range meteor scatter, long-range moon bounce, whatever. Super, super weak signals, where the human ear would require a signal as strong as a, you know, 0 dB signal-to-noise ratio. The system can operate with minus 28 and give you 90% copy message. And because the system automatically repeats the message, and it tells you what is the probability of error, and it's got an error-correcting code built into it, we've come a long way. So when you start applying modern-day technology to the problem of long-range propagation, you could say to some degree we don't need quite as much help from Mother Nature and the super high activity sunspot cycles, where we're communicating tremendously longer distances under mediocre conditions. To have great communication, but it only occurs once every 100 years, is nowhere near as exciting, in my opinion, as developing the hardware and the techniques and the protocols which will allow you to do it every single day under normal conditions or even poor conditions. That, to me, is a more interesting challenge. So, although I certainly appreciate it, I do remember during the 1958 period, I was working at Telephonics Corporation in Huntington at the time, and the man who worked with the chief engineer was John Richter. I can't remember the name of the ham radio operator, who had some spare 1-watt output, 50 megacycles. They were good up to 100 megacycles, or maybe 200 megacycles. These Westinghouse transistors. No, Western Electric transistors, good for 1-watt output, up to approximately 200 megacycles. And he took one of the defective ones, made a 50 megacycle 1-watt transmitter in the laboratory in his spare time, and by double hop 6-meter propagation with a very simple antenna on the building, he was talking to California at 6 meters. So that's QRP, free power, running on a 12-volt battery, so to speak. Fun type stuff took place due to that sunspot cycle. Okay, we'll discuss this a little bit more, Hugo, after we go down the list. There's two or three more guys to go to. Mike was the next person to sign in. Kilo Charlie 2, Oscar November Alpha, Oscar Lima Alpha, if I've got it right, Mike. You've got it, K2IW on the TechNet. Okay, maybe Mike's not available. Gordon gave his testimony, which I appreciate. I think we've gone down the list. Have I missed anyone so far who wanted to check into the TechNet? Give me a call that is a name right now.
WS2N Paul, and good evening, Dick. No comments at this time, or no questions.
Paul recognized, glad to hear from you, and we're looking forward to your space report, Paul, if you have anything to report. And I did catch a little bit of NASA Select on the satellite system that exists in Roscoe, New York. This morning I was in Roscoe, New York, a place where about 160 miles or so airline from here. I'm attending a very interesting event that I'll have to tell you guys about. There's a branch of electronics that has gone very far. Wow. These guys are something else. I'm talking about extremely high power electric motor type aircraft, radio controlled aircraft. Wow. That's another whole subject. Anyhow, I watched NASA Select, and I know that a press conference was held this morning from Houston, I think it was, describing something about the preparation for the next mission, and maybe you'll be telling us a little bit more about that. Anyone else that wants to check in, give me your call letters right now.
KC2, Bravo Yankee Victor, David Dan, and Cooking Dan.
Very fine, Dan. Glad to hear you. Bravo Nancy Victor, glad to hear you check in. I'm going to turn it over to Mel because he's always got something to tell us about. Give us a little bit of a hint as to How fat is the mailbag this week? Tell us what the merry men of the Kings County Radio Club are doing. After that, we'll go over, you'll give us a brief start on that one, Mel. We'll go over the polls report, and then we'll come back to you for the serious stuff. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Hey, thank you. This is K2KEY. Well, we had something very, very interesting today. We had our picnic, our yearly picnic of the King County Radio Club at Manhattan Beach here, right at the edge of the ocean and little picnic areas that we brought our antennas and our rigs. We have everything run off. Had a runoff battery. Not the generator to be brought into the park. So we had a nice afternoon. We all got together. We were there for about 4 hours. And it's just a nice get-together with everybody and talked about everything from A to Z, including ham radio. Just a couple comments I was going to make before I turn it over to Paul. Most of the, we were talking about neutralization a little while ago. I'm going to make some comments about that real quick. I don't know if you can pick up maybe on it later on. But, most of these tubes are fairly well screened. So that, I've experimented, of course, quite a bit with all these tubes. A number of amplifiers. And these are ceramic vinyl tubes, such as you were using his amplifier, Richard's using it as his amplifier, plus my ones I've been using in a number of amplifiers I built, 3CX800. They are, they're sufficiently well screened so that, series inductive neutralization fixing is not really necessary, on lower frequencies especially. However, series capacitance tuning of the grid return may be required in some instances to prevent oscillation, Dick. It's mostly what I have found that, working with IMAC previously on a number of the projects going way back, I've had that discussion, and it seems like they have also usually seen the same situation as more or less in the correspondence agreed with me that it was mostly series capacitance tuning of the grid return that was required to prevent the oscillation stick over.
I guess that doesn't surprise me. I do know you, when you've got active amplification going on within a device, be a tube, transistor, or whatever, you desire maximum decoupling between the input circuit and the output circuit in order to make things stable. The most desirable kind of an amplifier is one that's called unconditionally stable. That means now, no matter how you tune the input circuit, no matter how you tune the output circuit, it's not going to break into oscillation. A circuit that is conditionally stable, where it's only stable if you properly load it, and if you go a little bit off proper loading, it becomes unstable. Can be kind of a hairy thing to use, and it can be kind of troublesome. By the way, one of the things I want to mention that I keep forgetting to mention is that from time to time, Mel and I get letters, phone calls, and whatever, saying, how can I find out who owns tape recordings of the TechNet? In other words, Mel may have given a lecture on the SNET chart, and you'd like to review it. And believe it or not, there's a not extremely high-fi, but more than adequate fidelity recording of every single one of the TechNets going back at least a year, and more of them will be showing up. If you go to the website of a very enthusiastic man in New Jersey, you go to the website of amateurradio.tv, I'm going to spell that, AmateurRadio, amateur radio with a double R between the two words, so to speak, and no punctuation, amateurradio.tv, not .org, not .net, but .tv, Tango Victor. You go there and you'll find that every one of the technets up until a week or so ago are documented every 5 minutes or so, and you'll find out what subject is being discussed. If that particular subject is the one you want to know about, and he tells you that particular night it's on the third reel. Each one of these reels, as I call them, are 1 hour long. You go to that particular reel, you play the reel, or by way of the index, you can find out that the subject you're interested in is 35% of the way into that reel, and you skip to that position and start listening to what Mel and Dick have to say. So, we're being recorded. Careful what you say, you guys. You're becoming part of history. And so these questions and these answers, you have access to them. And so I'm awful forgetful, awful grateful that somebody has done that. Mel and I are busy enough doing what we do, trying to stay alive and trying to keep our families happy. And from time to time, people will say, gee, why don't you tape record what you do? Well, I just haven't gotten enthusiastic enough to do that. Somebody has done it, so maybe you'll appreciate that. Let's find out what's going on in space. Paul, when's the next launch? I hope we're still in line for fixing the Hubble Space Telescope. I'm a Hubble hugger, and I really want that piece of machinery to continue. I do know I can tell by the progress report that was being given on NASA TV this morning, for those few people who get it on their satellite system or on their cable system. They're still discussing chunks of foam coming off the tank, and they're applying more and more correction techniques. They think they've got it down to the point where the critical positions on the tank are no longer shedding foam, but they admit that foam can shed on every single mission. And as you know, the Columbia disaster occurred because a very large chunk of foam, which in my mind had ice in it, struck the leading edge of the Space Shuttle Columbia on launch. Poked a great big hole in that reinforced carbon-carbon, the RCC leading-edge tile. The leading-edge tiles are capable of tolerating 4,000-degree temperatures. And when you got a hole in that protective tile, and those very hot gases come roaring through the hole and melt the aluminum inside the wing of the space shuttle, and the wing gets melted and falls off, that's essentially what happened in Columbia. You know what the results are, so you really got to make sure that foam doesn't fall off the external tank during the launch, and that subject was one of the major subjects being discussed this morning. So over to you, Paul, if you happen to have some further reports on anything that NASA is doing, because some of us who are scientifically interested really like hearing the inside information as to what they're doing, particularly with their far-flung spacecraft. I'm still amazed that the Voyager spacecraft, with its little 10-watt transmitter and nuclear power supply, way out there beyond Pluto, is still talking to us. And if you hear about how that unified S-band space system and X-band system works, it's quite a bit of magic. WS2N, K2LIW on the deck, man.
Okay, very good, Dick. And, the STS-120, they're calling it, for October. Last time I heard it was still a go. I was a little concerned after the last flight of STS-118 that had a small damaged tile in the belly of the craft from that foam. So I was thinking, well, maybe they're going to stop this thing for another couple of, maybe half a year or something to redesign it again. But apparently they're going ahead with it. Have a number of spots on that external tank, they call it the POW unit, which is essentially a tray for wires going down. That was the main problem for Columbia, where foam popped off in that area. They're running an oxygen, 17-inch diameter oxygen line down that tank. Areas like that have been addressed, as well as the location where the shuttle actually bolts onto the tank. That area to have problems. I think they should take some away in that area. Other locations they added are heaters. I remember you recommended that some years ago, putting heaters here and there. they have done that type of thing. And I guess this is not as worrisome as I originally thought with that with the last.